Aloha! You are listening to Inside the Desert Oasis Room, episode number 28.
This episode is sponsored in part by Lost on 111 Grill and Art Lounge, located in La Quinta, California. Lost on 111 is a family-run business that serves traditional American and island-inspired breakfast and lunch items, including hefty-size omelets, biscuits and gravy, chicken and waffles, locomocos, huli-huli burgers, salads, and more, and all cooked and prepared by a Navy veteran chef. Come try their house mimosa, the Lost Mosa, a delicious combination of Pog and almond champagne for only $4. And speaking of champagne, how about something exotic like Coconut Nui or Tahitian Vanilla, both by Wilson Creek Winery in Temecula. Lost on 111 is open Wednesday through Saturday from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and Sundays from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. For more information, visit their Facebook page or webpage at lostononeeleven.com. This episode is also sponsored in part by Bamboo Ben. Bamboo Ben is an artist and builder that specializes in tropical decor for the island lifestyle. He's also built or contributed to tiki temples such as Don the Beachcomber, Frankie's Tiki Room, The Luau, Kontiki, Forbidden Island, Kona Club, Royal Hawaiian, and more. Find him on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. He builds stuff for you.
On this episode, we speak with Sven Kirsten. Sven is widely regarded as the man who instigated the modern tiki revival. He wrote the Book of Tiki, which chronicled the mainland American movement of Polynesian pop, which is a term that he also coined himself. He followed that with Tiki Modern, a book that shows the juxtaposition between primitive and modern art. And he followed that up with Tiki Pop, which is also accompanied with an exhibition in Paris, France. We sit down on his patio on a warm spring night with a couple boxes of Cuban cigars and a large dispenser of rum punch made by our friend Boris Hamilton. It was great having Boris sit down with us because Boris added a perspective to our talk and asked some questions that I would not have thought of asking. So thanks, Boris, for helping out with the interview. I really believe you guys are going to enjoy this one. Thanks again for all your support on the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our previous episodes, a share on your social media is always appreciated. And so without further ado, I bring to you the godfather of modern tiki, Mr. Sven Kirsten. Where did that tiki come from?
That tiki was carved for his show in Paris.
Oh, okay.
Jamie...
That explains why it's familiar looking to me,
mm-hmm.
without me knowing where it came from.
And it's based on that menu, the Mai Tai room that Kahala Charms had. It's in Tiki Pop. So
right.
They based a tiki, they carved a tiki based on that drawing. And it was in the bar in the hotel, in the museum.
Okay.
And I was like, are you going to get it back? And he's like, I don't think so. It's going to be too much for them to ship. And then it showed up.
So they sent it back.
Yep.
There are certain things that it sounds like, that he was probably one of them that he at one point had to accept that he'd probably never get back.
Right.
It's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
I bought this shirt just recently at this Western store in San Fernando. It's a cool old Western store. Got the name of it, but it's really like it's like, you know, the by the San Fernando Mission, and I've never been there actually, and they have this like little main street there still, and it's like this very original Western store they have.
Is that mission just for tours, or is it active as a church, or do they still
doing a church? Yeah, it has a cemetery that recently was accused of foregoing maintenance because somebody couldn't find their family's grave or something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have you ever been down to the cemetery in Old Town San Diego?
No.
So they have a cemetery there that's a couple hundred years old.
Mm.
And by law, you have to have grave markers where there are graves.
Okay.
So they built a street over part of it.
And because of that, you'll see grave markers in the asphalt in the middle of the street.
Oh, jeez.
No.
Not kidding.
That's cool.
You know who brought me over there was Al Nepper.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, he drove me through there, and he said, check this out. So we parked the car, and actually where we parked the car was over some grave sites. You could
but
see.
But it's like a 200-year-old grave, so.
The grave markers there on the sidewalk, they're kind of all scattered about. And if you walk out into the middle of the street, you could see them out in the middle of the street also. Mm. It's by the Whaley House, which is a popular... they do like ghost tours at that.
Okay, is that the same day that you guys went ghost touring?
It was that night, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So they have this house used to be, I guess, like a courthouse at one time, and then but it had history, you know. I think before it was a courthouse. I don't know if it was before or afterwards.
Yeah, the train?
Yeah, where's the train?
It's over by the river.
It's just a ghost train.
I just love the distant sound of it. I wouldn't want to live right next to it.
No.
But you know, just kind of the echo.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess this where the Whaley House is, they used to have the gallows where they would hang.
Oh, geez.
Where they would hang people, and then at one point it became a courthouse, and then it became, I don't know if it was the Whaley House after or before or after the courthouse, but. It's known as the Whaley House today, and I believe that there were some suicides at the house. And
that's weird. You don't really think of San Diego as Wild West.
Yeah. You know, I took photos in there's a theater room, and I picked up a couple of orbs. Although it could just be dust particles that are moving in the air that my flash.
Oh.
But they look like orbs to me.
Okay.
You know, and the thing is, if you look at the room, everything looks normal, and then when I turn my phone flash on, as soon as the light turns on, you look at the screen of your phone, you see a bunch of orbs just like flying around the room.
Ah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Well, thanks for clarifying also that you were there at night, you know, because ghost hunting during the day isn't as exciting.
Well, I don't know even if they do tours during the day, but we did that at night. So, and then we went to a few places that were, I don't know if they were haunted. You know, we went to an old Victorian house. I don't remember the name. And then we went to another place that used to be a place where at one time, and I might be getting this wrong, but it was yellow fever or something that plagued this particular part of San Diego.
Nice.
And so when people were getting sick, they were sending them to this one specific home to die, essentially.
Oh.
And so something like over 400 people died in this home. And so that house is full of spirits, and they handed out EMF meters, and people's meters were going off and mine wasn't. I was really disappointed because I wanted mine to go off so I could take a nice picture and video for my Facebook, right? And of course, I was getting nothing. And so some of the girls that were getting these, you know, beep, 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 beep on their meters with the needle pegged all the way to the right.
Right.
I would walk over there with my meter and put it right next to theirs, and mine would just be dead. But it was working because the lights were on the meter. I would just get no response from it.
That sounds fishy.
It was frustrating.
Yeah.
So, but it was working for all the girls that were getting scared. You
okay,
know?
Right.
All right. Maybe that's what it's mirroring. It's like.
So, if I moved.
The Scientology e-meter. You know?
Right. If I moved and I said, let me step around this person so that I can get a better view of this building that we were in, standing in front of, so I can get a nice photo of it.
Right.
Sometimes the girls would. They would look at me and say, "Who's that? Was that you? Was that you?" And I'd be like, "Yes, it was just me. I'm just trying to get a better angle."
You can't blame them, though. I mean, if you're like, "Okay, we're going to go in here and it's going to be scary," then well, immediately your whole, like, everything is scary.
Well, I suppose
over.
That, you know, that's something that that they came to see, so that if, you know, they've already got that in their head, right?
Right.
But I found it comical, so. And we went on Friday the 13th just to make it more interesting. Not that the ghosts only come out on Friday the 13th.
Most ghosts keep a calendar. They know what's
Naomi
going on.
Has a sensitivity for these things. She sees things in old buildings. And she did see things at Dawn the Beachcombers, actually.
Yeah, I've heard stories about Dawn's.
Supposedly it was, according to what she saw, it was a, what do you call it, you know, prohibition... illegal prohibition joint.
Speakeasy,
right?
Right.
Where people would gamble and drink.
Right.
And of course, and because of the stuff would come in from from the beach, you know.
Right.
Or from the, maybe through the channel in the back. I don't know.
Yeah, through the back, because before those condos were back there, the water went up to the back of that building, right? There was a dock back there.
There still is. I mean, yeah, besides, you know, behind...
Well, now there's a parking lot
and
those condos.
Yeah.
You know, but before they filled in part of that bay, there was a dock back there for... where they would offload. And this is all... what is it? Folklore.
Folklore, right. You're right.
Yeah, but, I mean, she didn't know any of that.
Yeah.
And that's what she saw from, like, the period. And of course, there was, you know, since it was illegal, there was kind of, you know, there was unhealthy things going on, you know.
Of course. Well, the story that I was told was the rooms down in the basement were full of illicit activities.
Right.
From prostitution to gambling to alcoholic consumption during Prohibition. And there's maybe a half dozen rooms down there.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is all folklore. I wasn't there, right?
Well, that's, you know what, like, when you hear that, like, Don's location was probably picked for that, because I think
yes,
it's still unincorporated. I think, you know,
it's still kind of a weird thing, but
that makes sense.
When you say that it was picked for something like that, it makes sense, because if there were illicit activities happening, they would do it somewhere where, you know, it would be hard to, you know, like you say, you'd have to get there by boat,
right?
Like offshore gambling, you know, gambling boats and things like
right.
that. Even though that wasn't on a boat, it was still set away from probably the more populated parts of the city.
Right. And, you know, look, I don't know everything.
You know?
Almost everything. But, you know, back then, when did Don's open? I'm sorry, let's call it Sam's. When did Sam's open?
Late 30s? Like 1930s.
Okay, so if it was Prohibition, that was the, you know, 20s. So, you know, back then, if a sheriff had to come out to Don or to Sam's, he's coming from Orange, you know?
Right.
And it's a pain in the ass to get there now with the freeways. Can you imagine coming from
right.
the Orange Circle,
over
left,
dirt.
Left, right, left?
Right.
Oh, forget it.
Dirt roads.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, Sven,
hmm.
is you had told me a story one time about when you were first noticing and documenting all of these old Polynesian-styled buildings and tiki temples. And you had said, you know, when I first started to notice these things, they really fascinated me because it looked like something that everyone was, you know, had either forgotten or was just embarrassed to admit was part of the landscape. And when I realized how prolific it was, I thought, you know, somebody should write a book about this. And then one day you realized that you knew more about it than anybody else.
Mm.
And that the only way that a book would be done with that was if you wrote it.
You know, the really that thought entered my mind really when I discovered Oceanic Arts. Because it was still when Oceanic Arts was still in their old location up the street from where they're now. You know, where they got kicked out of because of eminent domain, the city, I think, of Video 1 and 2.
They put the freeway there, right?
Something. But it was this old warehouse, and I had found it because the guy at Benson's, also still in their old location, not where they are now, sort of begrudgingly told me about Oceanic Arts. When I found Benson's in the yellow pages, like, you know, it said something like seashells and tropical decor or something. I went there, and they didn't have much tiki stuff, but they did have the Covarrubias maps in their bathroom, and
okay.
at the time they didn't want to sell them to me, but I did, you know, needle the guy for, like, is there anything else like that? And then he's like sort of like
right,
you know, and when I went there, you know, I always like to tell that like Leroy was sitting behind the counter and he had his head in his hand like this, and there was like, it seemed like there was a spider web going on
between his arm and his head. They were that slow.
Yeah. But you know, I got to talk to about Leroy. He saw how enthusiastic I was about the whole thing, and he like immediately pulled out from underneath the counter, he pulled out a stack of menus.
Yeah.
All these places that they had worked at, and I you know, I like sifted through the menus and saw these incredible graphics on the covers, and that's when I thought, man, somebody should make a book about this, you know?
Yeah, I remember you saying to me, you know, I kept saying, somebody should make a book about this. Mm. And then I would share this information with other historians. And I quickly learned that a lot of them didn't know what I knew because you were the one that was most fascinated by it.
Well, I just had, you know, I had collected stuff already and collected information. And it wasn't really historians, it was scenesters like me.
Oh, scenesters. I was thinking more of like...
No.
Preservationists.
Yeah, they didn't really... I mean, there was some, you know, L.A. Modcom was also probably already in existence, but I didn't know Pete Maruzzi then. No, what I did, I went to this Bahuka event from the Cacophony Society, which was this sort of prankster society that existed, I think, in San Francisco also, and they put on these events, and they on their schedule, it was 1992, put on this tiki event that was hosted by a friend of mine. And so I went there, and there were like 8 to 10 people. We all sat on a big table at Bahuka's and talked tiki, and that's when I sort of, you know, realized, wow, I actually know much more than any of these guys. So,
right.
You know, maybe if nobody's doing it, I should be doing the book. And I never entertained the idea of doing a book because I was a cameraman. But, yeah, that's when that sort of seed was planted in my mind. And I went out and photographed the apartment buildings I knew and some other places, collected some material. And then...
How long ago was that?
It was in the early 90s.
Okay.
And my first proposal was ready in 92. And I still have this nice rejection letter from Chronicle Books.
Mm-hmm.
That says, like, yeah, I understand, Sven, it's a nice idea. I understand what you're trying to do. But most of the younger members in my office didn't get it. And it's too much on too small of a subject. And I'm like, oh, that's what's so great about it.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's a small subject, but it's all this incredible stuff that I'm finding.
Do you think that if you didn't write the book, that it would be something that would have just been forgotten? Or do you think somebody else would have filled that spot?
Probably to some degree, because... At towards the end, like, you know, I in the late 90s, I heard about other people wanting to do some book on tiki here and there, that nothing, you know, just as a warning to people that want to do something on something else, a book project or so, don't let yourself get deterred by hearing about other projects like it.
Right,
because
right.
They most likely will never come to fruition.
Well, the reason why I ask that is I mean, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who believes this, but that book is what started the whole revival. So without that book, it makes me wonder if there would have even been a revival.
But you were revivaling before the book came out.
Yeah, but you know,
is that a word?
Always
it is now.
No, that's a very nice verb there. We will include this revivaling. But you know, it was all in this kind of underground that was happening. You know, Tiki News. You know, I met Otto early on, so I was, you know, like the so-called executive editor, although I didn't do much editing. I just contributed on Tiki News. From the first issue on. But, you know, it was like a fanzine on brown paper in black and white. So it's, you know, its effectiveness was very limited.
Right.
And that's also the reason why it took me 8 years to find a publisher for the Book of Tiki, because I wanted it to be in full color and, you know,
yeah,
be a real quality book and not just... you know, the guys from Amok Books here in L.A. hooked me up with research up in San Francisco. They did these great you know, they did like two volumes on Exotica alone that are like the standard works on Exotica music and Exotica collectors. But they were all in black and white because at the time then, now color is not even a question anymore in publishing, you know.
Right.
But back then, it was like prohibitively expensive for smaller publishers. So I could have done it earlier with those guys, but I didn't want it to stay within the circle of
hipsters
and you know.
I don't want to use the word.
You didn't want to see. He didn't want it to stay underground, is that
right?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
I wanted
no, because research also, like, you know, they've got books on piercings and tattoos.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, they got all this, which is cool stuff.
It's cool stuff.
It stays,
but it would stay.
You know, I had the experience of going to the San Francisco Art Institute when I came here to America in the early 80s, and going there and going to being in this artsy scene where each other would go to each other's openings, and it wouldn't go any further out
right,
in the world,
right.
You know? And I wanted to be like, you know, I wanted to have it to be again pop culture, again, popular culture.
So I have a couple questions about all that too, because number one, when you were shopping the book for 8 years, was the book done while you were shopping it? Or in that time, were you learning more about the Polynesian pop era and expanding the book as you were waiting for a publisher?
Yes, I was expanding it material-wise because I kept on collecting and more stuff was popping up. But the spine of the book, the, you know, when I look at the chapter index of my proposal from 92 and the book, the way it came out, it's pretty much identical.
Okay.
It's already sort of in my head. I mean, it was dictated by the evolution that I saw happening, you know, from... We all know it now. Don the Beachcomber to Trader
right,
Vic
right.
to on and on and
right.
to the you know appearance of the tiki icon in that evolution, and that was already sort of set in my mind in the proposal early on. But yeah, I you know my goal was really to go bring it to a wide audience, and I wanted to have good distribution, because I've also, from working in the film industry and working like in low budget movies throughout the 80s, I've had the experience of directors and filmmakers sinking their, you know, money and blood and sweat into their projects, and finally maybe they got the film done.
Mm-hmm.
But if it didn't have distribution, nobody would see it. So,
you know, there's a lot of projects like that.
Yeah.
That get done and no one sees them.
Nowadays, you know, at least you have the internet, so you have a chance of breaking in that way. But now that, you know, Netflix and Amazon and stuff, they're all, they're, you know, it's really a crowded market. There's so much
right.
stuff out there.
Right.
Who's going to see it all? My
yeah.
God.
Yeah, well, that's why they try to create all that buzz, you know, because word of mouth is really the thing now that gets people to watch things, I think.
Right. So how did you get hooked up with Tashin?
I was through my friend Pete Maruzzi, who until recently just lived across the lake from me. You know, and I had met Pete in 92 at a event of the Forum of Architecture and Design or something, where he did a lecture about motels. In the same evening, I did a lecture.
Were they a specific style of motel?
No, there was just you know the history of motels in America.
But actual motor hotels.
Yeah, he had collected postcards and stuff. You know,
right?
Like I
right.
had collected TV stuff, and then you know I became friends with Pete. He's really one of my oldest friends in LA. And he was, you know, the ModCom, LA ModCom chair at the time, and knew this Swiss architect named Frank Escher, who had done a nice thick book on John Lautner, the architect, a very cool mid-century modern mm-hmm. architect here in California and beyond. And Benedict Tashin was, you know, had just bought the Chemisphere. That was like much later on, you know, in the 90s. And he had hired Frank Escher to renovate the chemisphere for him because Frank had done this book about Lautner.
Oh, so wait, Lautner did the chemisphere?
Lautner did the chemisphere.
So he hired Frank Escher, who did the book,
right,
to redo the chemisphere, or to upgrade the...
Yeah.
Okay.
And Pete was friends with Frank, so Pete said, why don't you give me my proposal? I'll give it to Frank Escher, who's just working on the chemistry, and he will give it to Benedict Tushin. And that's how that went. And then I got a call from Benedict in 1999, towards the end of 1999. And he said, I'm interested in doing book. And he wanted to come over on January 1st. Of 1992. It was like, doesn't the guy have anything better to do? He had just moved here, and I guess he didn't know anybody else.
Okay.
So he came over, and I had done like a nice little folder of like my best images. There was mm-hmm. 30 of the key images and stuff. And he went like, cool. What else do you got? And he proceeded to go through every one of my folders of slides and stuff that I had collected, which by, the late 90s was a nice...
Was a lot, but yeah.
But he's like, didn't stop. He like was leafing through it all. And it really made sense later on because Tosh and Pokes are such complete companions. They're such thick, volumes of stuff. He was not only looking for quality, but he was looking for quantity.
Right.
And when he had seen all the material that I had, he felt like, we can do a book about this.
So, I know that when the book first came out, there's a lot of stuff that I want to ask you, and I know a lot of some of the answers, but I think that our listeners would find interesting that when the book first came out, there were a couple chapters that you had to cut out.
Oh, it was just it was really just...
And also, how much material did you want to include that ended up not being included? You get like 90% of this stuff in there?
I would say so, yes. Because at the time, Tashin was just beginning here in America. And the Book of Tiki was really the first, as far as I can tell, was like the first American publication they did. Because they had done...
Oh, okay.
They had done books about Julius Shulman in the early 90s, and I think it was 96. When I was working in Germany, in Cologne at the time, I went to the Tashin bookstore and I saw this Joel Schumann book, and it was so beautiful. I said, well, maybe,
right,
I should try them. But, it was the first time since Tashin had moved to L.A. that he was doing this book with his company. And anyway, I lost my train of thought. What did I want to talk about?
How much of the book was cut out?
Oh yeah.
And how much of it did you want in there that you were able to keep?
Yeah, like you said, it was
about 90%.
I was able to keep like 90% of what I wanted to be in the book in there, because they didn't have any set rules at the time. And I was able to talk them up, each time they gave me the page limit, I came back and said, can I have, maybe like 10, 15 pages more? And I think three times I got to add pages, which was great. The only thing that where I had to compromise was, like you mentioned, I wanted to do a chapter about exotica music. And,
right.
At the time, Benedict Tashin also had the great idea of including an exotic music CD at the end of the book, in the sleeve, stuck in the end page of the book. And I thought it was would be cool, but when it came down to it, he said, the price is going to go up that much. You have the choice. Either, you cut these number of pages and we include the CD, or you can have all your pages, almost all your pages, and we won't do a CD. And, I wanted it to be a book, not sort of like a party thing.
Sure.
So,
But was that extra cost just Was it because of licensing the music?
I don't know if it was licensing.
Because I think, you know, if you just charged a little bit more for the book, I think people would have paid for it.
Yeah, but, you know, again, my goal was for it to be affordable enough to make it popular.
I think
it would have been over $50.
It was a $30 book, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what helped it, you know? That's what made people go and buy it indiscriminately, rather than it being, you know, like a $50 art book. And that's why I made that choice. And so, of course, since the CD was not going to be in it anymore, I also cut out the Exotica chapter, which I thought had, you know, it already had been covered in other books in the genre. So it wasn't as essential.
And there was a TV chapter too, right?
Oh, I got the TV chapter.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's in there.
Okay, you know, so I'm just thinking of the music. Okay.
Yeah, it was just, you know, it was...
If my book's covered in signatures, I can't really read it anymore.
You only have one?
If I counted all the versions I have, I probably have six or seven.
Oh, wow.
Because I have two of the hardback, which is the first printing.
Right.
And then I have the soft cover, which came out a little bit later.
Okay.
And then all... There's three different versions of the smaller tiki style.
Okay.
And I have all different versions. One of them, two of them were sold. I think there was two different styles sold at Old Navy. And there was one version that was sold that was censored.
That was the Old Navy version.
Okay, so the Old Navy.
Yeah, because it's a family store. They wanted
but I do have a
nudity out.
I do have three that happen to be, they all are different in some different way.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, whether it's the typeset on the front or the contents inside.
Wow.
So I remember waiting for that book to get released.
What? Which?
Book of Tiki.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I remember being frustrated when the original release date appeared to keep getting pushed back. Because it was supposed to be released, if I remember correctly, by the holidays, and then it got pushed back after the holidays.
It was released in September.
So they ruined your Christmas.
Well, it was supposed to be released the holiday before. I remember saying, I remember telling the story to people that I felt like I waited an extra year to get it after I knew that it was going to be released. Ah. So if it was released in September, that makes sense because I expected it to come out before the holidays the year prior.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know where I got that from. Maybe I got that from Bob and Leroy at Oceanic Arts.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah, that was, you know, classic because, you know, I had early on told Bob and Leroy, you know, please don't give your stuff out to other people because I'm going to do the definitive book on Tiki.
Yeah.
You know, you have...
were they giving it to other people?
Well, there were other people that were asking and stuff, and I don't know. You know, like, nothing ever came out off these other projects, so...
Right.
You don't know. But I tried to protect, you know, the originality of my book by telling them that. And after a while, of course, it was like, you know, I started doing that in early to mid-90s. And after a while, it was like, yeah, sure, you're going to do the name now.
Yeah.
And by the late 90s, I wasn't even, you know, so sure anymore myself.
Don't even bring it up.
So, you know, it was just a really great feeling to find, then, you know, present Bob and Leroy with the finished book and say, here it is, and I told you so.
Did they sell it at Oceanic Arts too?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Good.
Oh, I remember the first signing party you had there where they served Mai Tais out of a clamshell bowl.
Oh, yeah.
That's when I met Judd.
Oh, okay.
It was before, you know, it was like way, way back in the early days. It was before there was any kind of...
revival.
Yeah, at all.
Right, right.
And, you know, one of the things that you pointed out in the book... And I'm curious if you noticed this before the book or if you noticed this while you were writing the book, is how many people stole from each other. How many restaurants stole images and art and, you know, names and logos and that kind of stuff. Did you notice that while you were writing the book or did you notice that before you wrote the book and that was part of the story wanted to tell?
I noticed it before and I you know, I didn't really... looked down on it because, I mean, it was just...
Well, that's part of the history.
A form of inspiration and a form of how the whole thing spread, you know? And, you know, the reason was that there was much more of it in California, for example, and much less of it in smaller places. So these smaller places, you know, had to find their art somehow, and they just, you know, used the art of the bigger places.
One of my favorite things about that is, which I didn't know, and I don't think anyone knew until you did the Tiki T logo mug, which was the Contiki, the Steve Crane Contiki logo.
Yeah.
When it was 3D put together, oh, its face is the Mark Thomas Outrigger mug.
Right, yeah. Right.
That is such a like a cool, happy like happy accident.
Yeah, and that and that badly rendered in the Contiki menu. That's, you know, the way they sort of messed up the nose, I first wanted to correct that in my mug, but then I said, no, this is actually a cool part of it.
Right.
The mistakes are all part of the history.
Yeah.
And I call this copying from each other the transmission tradition in Polynesian pop. You know, it was just, you know, going through different mutations.
Well, you know, Boris and I have a theory about that. We think that it was an ad agency that just made it easier for these restaurants to place orders for their swizzle sticks and the menus that they were getting printed. That, like, oh, you want a tiki? Well, we have this design.
Well,
and so they would choose that design, and so would the guy, you know, in the next city over, or the next, or the guy down the street.
Well, that was definitely the case with, like, Akigari, I think. Everyone's got the three-faced bucket mug.
Yeah, the mug companies did that. I mean, otherwise, why would the Tiki Bob, which was like a definitely designed logo only for Tiki Bob, end up being an Elvis Presley Blue Hawaii mug? You know, it's because the reps for the mug company would show these designs to other people, and you know,
sure,
they would say, yeah, I want that. But otherwise, you know, that was just part of it, I think. You know, there was also somebody found this catalog for a menu company, not the Big Lord menu company, that had designs, you know, had pages and pages of menu designs with no names on them. And they would just sell the designs to, like, a Chinese
place. So you just buy the background
or a coffee shop. Yeah, you would buy the design and then plop your name on it.
Okay.
But I don't think there wasn't really that many ad agencies there. Then it was more, you know.
Well, not so much added, just like a hub of, like, here's what I need, here's what we got.
Because, you know, there was companies like Orchids of Hawaii, and today Oriental Trading Company, right? They specialize in that kind of stuff.
Right.
Did you ever find out the history of OMC?
No.
That's still a mystery to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was, you know, Otagiri is a mystery. You know, they're why they were so dominant here in the LA market when they were really a Japanese company.
Right.
And how they managed to do that. They must have had really good salespeople that knew all the places.
Right.
But it's good to have a little bit of mystery. It's boring when everything has been
sure.
found out and
right.
it can be.
No, when we find cool new mysteries, you know, I can't think of any recent ones lately, but, you know, there's always something. Oh, the fact that Pagan Idol in San Francisco was in the other Tiki Bob's that was in San Francisco. And they didn't,
I know,
even,
that was
they didn't
amazing.
Even know that.
Yeah.
They didn't even know that.
That's, that's a little embarrassing.
They thought they were, like, somewhere down the street from it.
Right. It's like, no, this is the building. Oh.
This is a very
I need to turn in my Tiki card.
Yeah, I mean, but what have they done with it? Have they done anything with it?
Oh, they haven't. I don't think they've celebrated the Tiki Bob's aspect of it.
Yeah,
but they should. I think it's only been 6 weeks or something, maybe 2 months. But
yeah.
They need to. And, you know, of course, someone on Tiki Central found it out, figured it out, which is good. You got to give credit to Tiki Central when you can.
Yeah.
So when Tashin's telling you no CD, but, you know, since you're doing 10 more pages, is he telling you in German?
Yeah, probably. You know, his English wasn't that good at the time, so
okay.
we spoke German at the time. It you know, which brings me back to this complete irony of this whole, you know, purely American phenomenon being pushed out into the world by a bunch of Germans. I mean, what?
Right,
what's
with Jochen, and
Then Jochen comes around. He had already booked his trip to the South Seas as his wedding present, as his wedding holiday,
like a honeymoon. Or, yeah,
that's the name. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
And then he found my book. And
yeah.
That gave him the idea to make it into the DVD of Tiki. But, you know, why is the German, another German guy doing like the first full-scale documentary on it? Then, you know, why does the German label Bear Family Music publish
right.
my Sound of Tiki CD? And you know, it's strange.
Well, I have a theory on that. It doesn't completely explain it, but I think that a lot of it has to do with that, you know, it's a localism effect, right? We see it every day, so we don't appreciate it. But you guys, like when you first started discovering Tiki, you were new to the States.
Right.
And so you saw it with a different eye. You saw it as something that was, you know, wow, what is all this that we just kind of forgot about because right. we drive by it
every
day.
We're just numb to it.
Yeah, we're numb to it. Right. You know, we've become
but,
blind.
You know, I did pretty quickly find, people that had that same mindset, like Jeff Berry and Bosco, you know, were among my first friends in Tiki that you know, shared my fascination with it. The question, maybe it's, you know, it's this mixture of being, having a sort of a different perspective on the culture, but also my German sense of organization that put all these elements into place to make up this story of Tiki, to organize them. You know, when I see these things, you know, they kind of fell into place for me, and I organized
right.
them in a way that made sense, and maybe that's like a German trait. I don't know.
When you wrote Tiki Modern, was that information that you had maybe originally wanted to include in Book of Tiki?
Yeah, you know, if you remember, at the end of the Book of Tiki, I introduced, you know, I had the Witkobar at the beginning of
yes.
the Book of Tiki, because it was such a great example of so-called bad taste. But then at the end of the Book of Tiki, I also hint a little bit towards the fact that I was, you know, maybe going to do a book about Witko. Again, that was fueled by finding the Witko catalogs at Oceanic Arts, you know. I found this catalog, and they were like, you know, totally like looking down on that stuff at OA, of course, because it was too inauthentic for them.
Oh, yeah. I know that their goal was to try to stay as authentic as possible.
Right. But to me, it was like, you know, I was working on music videos in LA in the early 80s, and the catalog sets looked like from some Cramps video or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable to me that these actually people's, you know, living rooms and bedrooms and rumpus rooms had
right.
looked like this. So again, it was, yeah, it was coming from a different culture, from Europe, where there is what I, you know, call this high taste or the taste police is, you know, ridiculing anything like this. And that's, you know, why I liked it so much.
Right, right. Did they, at Oceanic Arts, did they view Witko as a competitor?
No, not seriously, because, you know...
I know that they worked with a lot of the old carvers, and they, you know, I don't know if they viewed any of them as competitors or if they viewed them as project partners, because I know that a lot of them worked on some of the same jobs together.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very a back and forth thing back in the day, you know.
Right.
Oceanic Arts, you know, they started competing with their own boss, you know, with Carter.
Right, Cargos by Carter.
and went into business for themselves.
Right.
So that's what happened to them also. Some of their carvers, you know, took on jobs by themselves that, you know, maybe correctly would have gone through Oceanic Arts. You know, everybody was trying to make a living. And, you know, but I don't think any, it wasn't like really like viciously competitive. It was just everybody was like trying to land a job, the next job.
Yeah.
Witco never entered into the Californian market much because there was so many other talents here. And, you know, CN Jungle and Oceanic Arts had sort of had the market covered.
Were you able to see CN Jungle before they went out of business?
Oh, yeah. That was my... that's definitely one of my key experiences.
Okay.
I found CN Jungle before Oceanic Arts, and that wasn't still in the 80s.
And how similar were they to Oceanic Arts? Were they completely different?
No, they weren't completely different.
Because they seem more like a nursery's kind of...
No.
The photos that I saw... It looked more like outdoor kind of decor.
No, it did. It was a big building with separate rooms, you know. And there was sort of like, you know, the Oceanic Arts hut that has like the cheap party decor. They had a room like that where I bought my first like Tiki Leilani mug.
Okay.
And they had the bigger tikis outside, but you know what they also had? They had a blacklight room. Which, again, to me...
Really?
And that had black light, or that had black velvet paintings in it, right?
Had black velvet paintings, like, but also, like, you know, black velvet, you know, South Seas landscape murals, and it was...
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
It was fantastic.
Bring that back.
You know, and I always mention it, you know, in my evolution of becoming and getting into tiki as the experience of loss, of having been there maybe two or three times, and I was still going to AFI at the time. So it was in the early 80s, and I was a film student. And of course, I didn't have any money, so the only thing I could afford was a Leilani mug. And then I did buy a tiki pole that I still have. It was a very simple, like, palm tree post with a simple tiki face carved in it, because again it was like, you know, the only thing I could afford at the times. And then it was like the third or fourth time I went back there. I was living in the Hollywood Hills, so I had to cross over the hills to go into the valley to San Fernando Road. That when I went back there after having been there only two or three times, they had closed shop.
Oh, God, that must have been devastating.
It was like, what? I just discovered this place.
Yeah, I've got $60 this time. I'm here.
I know. And we're like, what happened? How can they close?
Yeah, and I've seen Sven's first apartment in L.A. What were you driving at the time?
A 1960 Buick LeSabre.
Yeah.
Wait, is that gone? When did you sell that?
Yeah, that was... you know, it had turned into a barn find in my garage over the last 10 years because the transmission was shot and the neighbor's partiers had thrown a bottle and cracked the windshield.
Oh.
That was
a cool car. I remember that car. Yeah.
But just driving up and down these hills.
Yeah, that old car. Oh, man. So back then, I know that you're buying this stuff from, like, say, from CN Jungle, right? Were you also actively seeking out relics from a lot of these old places, or is that not something that you had thought about even starting collecting yet? I'm curious, like, because now that's a thing that everybody's doing, right? They're collecting things from these old places, but that's because of the awareness that was raised with, you know, the books and the websites that are out there, like Tiki Central.
Right. But,
like, there's a guy who started collecting tiki mugs. Were you one of those guys?
Because they were like the
but I mean, you were
most
doing
prevalent
for...
thing available, tiki
right,
mugs,
right?
You know? And they did have the restaurant's name on them, so yeah, there were clues to find.
But it was
out.
More for really the research of the book and having a little souvenir. It wasn't really about starting a collection.
And I think it was.
Today,
I think
right?
he was.
Oh, is it?
You were happy to collect anything at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And maps were just the most available thing in thrift stores for, you know, like $2 or $3.
Or even less, because I remember finding stuff for change.
I did a commercial 65
cents.
In Monterey one time, and I went to a thrift store there, and I found a Harvey's bucket mug, and I already had one or two at home. And there were two there. I picked the one I thought looked the best, and I brought it up the counter. And the woman goes, "Oh, today's 2-for-1 day." And she walked back
and get you the other
got me the other one and like wouldn't let me leave without
she
both
made
of
you
me.
Buy
she
it.
Made me buy them both.
Yeah, those were the days.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, but you know, I must say, the days are coming back to a certain degree, because vintage tiki mugs are not as sought after as they used.
You know, it's the thing is, it's been this way for a few years.
Yeah.
I've noticed that people won't spend $75 on a vintage mug, but they'll easily spend that on a brand new mug with 500 copies of the same mug.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
It was also the flood of Tiki Farm mugs out there has sort of like, you know, I mean, it's I think it's hard to appreciate for people that look for Tiki now what a find it was to find something, because it was rare.
Yeah,
it was
so
hard to find, and to, you know, to find a new mug that you hadn't seen before was like really this you know, discovery. And now, you know, you go on the internet and it's like this blob.
Everything's there.
Of mugs out there, yeah, and it's the sense of discovery is not there anymore. So in the sense of vintage and new has very much become muddled up. You know, just a couple of days ago, there were a bunch of Kahiki grog mugs. They're just like these little cups.
Right.
And the mold, the mold wasn't very good. They looked pretty washed out.
Okay.
You know? But there were like three of them, and they were under $100.
Wow.
And they had the Hoffman...
Yeah, the Hoffman pottery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, back, you know, just a couple of years ago, people would have
Killed each other for it. Yeah.
They didn't get a bid.
And you didn't tell me about this? Why?
See, I don't know. You don't want to spend $90 on you know, coffin mugs. But, it you know, I mean, now that... I guess it also has to do with the fact that the big players... like Koala Charms and stuff, they're like saturated. They have it all.
Right.
And so people are not bidding each other up. But I also think people don't understand the value of vintage.
I agree with you on that.
I still love vintage. And I like some newer pieces, but I like the detail and the colors of the vintage, you know.
Yeah, the history behind it. I mean, the Kahiki. I mean, come on, look at... what an incredible place that was.
So what are some of the...
you have anything from that place in your...
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a few pieces from the Kahiki's, mostly like mugs and that kind of stuff, just because it was, you know, I started collecting early on, so it was still more available then,
right?
You know. So speaking of the Kahiki, you know, in the early days, even especially before the book, you were doing a lot of urban archaeology. And I know I've seen pictures of you doing that with Jeff and a few others. Do you have any stories from that? What were some of the places that you've seen that are interesting to you? I know that, like, for me, you know, the days of urban archaeology now is there's every place that's still around has been discovered. And every place that has closed down that has not been discovered is gone, right? Or I shouldn't say that it's not been discovered. But I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, it's either already been discovered or it's gone. Mm. And, you know, there was one time that I passed by the tikis in Lake Elsinore just to see if I could find anything. And there's no tikis or anything left. But I found a dilapidated old building that still had all the old moldings and stuff that were painted on it. Uh-huh. And there was a big sign that was halfway buried in the ground that said Headhunters Pro Shop.
That might have been from the paint gun.
Oh, do you think? But this building, was old. It was the one I had posted pictures, and I believe that you commented that that upper level was the apartment that Danny Balls lived in.
Mm.
And I was excited to find that building because, you know, there's nothing left.
Yeah.
It's all gone. Everything that was had existed at one point is gone.
Last year, when me and you, we had lunch in Gardena.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
And I was leaving, yes. And I said, wait, you got to come over here. I called you on your cell.
Yeah.
And we found the cool apartments in Gardena. What are the...
It's the Islander?
Is it the Islander apartments in Gardena? It's behind the cool casino. Big tiki's.
What?
You know, the waterfalls.
It's well documented.
I think it's in probably all of your books.
Oh, the Exotic Isle?
No.
No, that's Alhambra.
Yeah. Anyway, it's in Gardena, and you know there's a huge, nice tiki out front.
Yeah.
So of course we stopped and we walked around.
And the waterfalls still work. The
waterfalls still work.
They didn't fill in the ponds. It's got running water.
Wait a minute. And now I want to know where Gardena doesn't ring a bell. Maybe I have it under another file under another town.
Okay.
What was the
I think you have like a 2-page spread in the apartment section of Bukittinggi.
What was the casino that we were at?
It was the Hustler Casino.
Hustler Casino.
But it used
so
to be
behind.
Right, but it used to be a different casino. It used to be like the Horseshoe or something.
So, yeah, that was, I mean, I didn't know about that. So Boris said, oh, you got to see this. And it's like finding a pyramid or something, you know?
And even though.
Isn't it great?
It's so awesome. I remember stumbling across the Kahlua apartments for the first time.
Right.
And that was, it's like finding a bar of gold.
I know.
You know? It's so awesome.
That feeling of you know, really, I mean, it really, I think, sums up the term urban archaeology.
When you're just like, what is this?
Yeah.
And then you pull over
in
and you you jump fences and you do things that you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
You know? There's a real excitement to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I don't live far away from where the Royal Tahitian was. Okay. And it was in the Bukittinggi.
Right.
And so I drove over there just to like see how much of that is left. There's really nothing left. And then I think that I got a note from you or something because I had posted a little something about it. And you said, can you go check the apartment buildings across the street? Because there was a Polynesian-style apartment
there were all
across
these,
the street.
There Milan Guanco tikis. That,
so I went to
they
that.
They didn't have names.
And the tikis are gone,
right.
And the ponds were filled in.
Right.
But they still had the lava rocks from where the waterfalls used to be. And
right.
You could see how it used to be a grand
Once you know
Polynesian-style.
Something was there, you can... There's like remnants that they can't get rid of.
Right. When you can see the bones, it's even that was exciting for a while.
Right.
You know.
Right. Oh man, the Royal Tahitian, that was such a great, the idea to make this A-frame is slanted in one direction. You know, it was like really a perfect union of modernism and, you know, Polynesian A-frame architecture. It was just fucking cool.
To
see the different, you know, the variety of concepts that people came up with at the time.
And there was, the cool thing was it was almost anything goes.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, nobody was.
Like, once you get to the Waikikian, it's like, okay.
Oh, the Waikikian.
Let's just do whatever we want because it's all cool.
The Waikikian is, that sweeping roof line that looked like somebody twisted a playing card and put it on top of a building.
Yep.
Yeah, that's really cool.
There was stuff left out of Tiki Modern, though, right?
There was?
Was there?
I don't know.
I know those pictures that ended up on the sleeve of The Sound of Tiki were part of Tiki Modern, right?
Maybe.
The inside with the rock walls.
It doesn't ring a bell. I'm just proud that I got Tiki Modern done because it was in an evening like this that Benedict Cashin was over here, and I got him drunk, and that's when I got him to realize the project.
That's how you proposed it to him. You got him drunk first.
Were you having him sign things?
No, he's a man of his word.
So even with the success of Book of Tiki, you still had to really sell it to him to do another book? Well, because then that one sold out too.
Yeah, but it wasn't as popular. It was just, I mean, the extreme aesthetics of Witco furniture carvings. Split the camps.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it was, aesthetically, it was a little bit more daring than maybe the Book of Tiki. And so that's maybe why I had to sort of talk him into. But luckily, you know, Benedict is you know, an enlightened arts patron. So, yeah. I would say this is it's still maybe my favorite book, the Tiki Modern, because it's so out there with its,
and it's more specific about it's a specific style.
Well, it's also what I, you know, what really fascinates me about Tiki the most is the clash of modernism and primitivism. You know, the extreme ends of the spectrum coming together. Mm-hmm. You know, in Witko furniture, you know, where the guy was equally adept in creating modernist, you know, decor as he was in doing primitive decor,
right?
And then also, you know, or the placing the primitive decor into like Eichler homes and stuff like that. You know, it was just it's a great contrast. I love it.
So, what's this new show you're working on in September?
Oh, The Art of Tiki. It's the 21st anniversary of the first Tiki art show at Wacko La Luz Gallery, and Otto is organizing all the art, the modern artist submissions. There's also going to be a room of vintage tikis for sale from the collection of Jordan Rychek, who is a animation director who had the finances to collect a lot of, you know, original vintage tikis, and is now, after he built his own tiki bar at home, he's now letting go of all the surplus.
Wow.
And I'm also gonna, it's not just gonna be the catalog for that, but it's really gonna be a book in its own right entitled The Art of Tiki. And I can just let go of, like, I'm gonna go into history a little bit, but I'm really gonna be able to talk about why tiki is an art form and what I love about it. It's gonna be fun.
Yeah.
And who are the artists that, that we know that are,
At the show?
Taking it out.
Well, you know, a lot of the veterans and some new people. I'm really leaving that to Otto, because he has done, you know, several art shows and book/catalogs about it with his Tiki Art Now series.
Which is a great series.
But, you know, I also want to talk about my other interests in Tiki Modern. I got to do just one page on another pet style of mine, the Mayan revival style from the 20s and 30s. And I'm doing this exhibition at the museum in Paris that I did my Tiki Pop show at this summer about that, in a smaller gallery, but it's going to be a fun show. And I'm also not in time for the exhibition opening, but, you know, later, maybe probably next year, I'm going to do a book about Mayan revival style.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
Yeah. And I got to be honest with you, man. I'm jealous that they're getting all these exhibitions over there.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
You know, like, it'd be nice to have had that exhibition find its way here.
The Germans put out the book. The Germans do the DVD and the CD. And then
the French have the
biggest, you know, exhibition on Tiki. Is done in Europe.
Right.
What's wrong with that?
Well, I might go to the Chris Nichols.
Yeah, Boris, what's wrong?
Show.
What's wrong?
Yes.
In the back room of a restaurant on Sunday.
Right. It's like, come on, people, get with it. You know?
We don't get anything right over here. We don't know.
It's always the K word, you know? they just think it's kitsch.
Yeah. You know what? I hate that word so much.
I hate it too.
Because to me, it makes it sound disposable.
It's a disparaging word.
Just use the word cool.
There you go.
Yeah.
With a K?
No.
like the cigarettes?
Like the cigarettes that you used to smoke in 1983? Were Kool's menthol, or were they just regular?
I think they were menthol.
Okay.
Hence the name. And when they were, they had the...
It was such a strange
They
idea
had the green...
They filled cigarettes
The box was white with the green, the logo was green.
Right.
And the highlights around the box, like the lines
And the
around
O's
the
did a crossover like the Olympic O's a little bit, I think, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Let's light up another Cuban here.
All right, I'm going to have a Cuban myself.
Pick one.
I might have to make myself another drink.
Make me one. Okay.
So I see three boxes of Cubans here, and I'm talking about cigars. What do we have? I saw Monte Cristo. Oh, Romeo.
I like my favorite Romeo and Juliet. For some reason, they're like.
And what's this one?
Partagas.
I don't know that one.
It's a classic.
I like these two. I'm going to have one of those.
Yeah.
Romeo and Julieta. Or Julieta.
You know, at this
Romeo
year's,
y Julieta.
At this year's TikiCon, I'm going to do a slide presentation about my time in Havana.
You good?
I'll take another one.
Okay. And you?
I'm going to sip with you.
Okay. I'm going to sip Jaeger.
You've been to Havana many times. Haven't you?
Twice.
I thought it was more than that.
No, the first time was in 2007 for Pete's Havana Before Castro book.
Right.
And that was incredible.
Yeah, let's give Pete a plug.
Havana Before Castro.
Havana Before Castro. And then he's got a few other great books. I know that...
Two Palm Springs book. And now coming out...
And I have Classic Dining.
Well, that was fun to photograph too. Because we got to go to all these restaurants, you know, throughout the United States. And then, you know, of course, we needed to photograph their food.
Their food, of course.
And then we got to eat it. And they were comping us already, but like at the Golden Steer in Las Vegas, you know, they serve like $80 steaks there.
Right.
So they comped us, and I had a really nice steak. And then we photographed a nice steak, and they, I said, like, so what are you going to do with this now after we've done photographing? Oh, we're going to throw it away. I'm like, no way.
No, no.
So I had two $80 steaks.
Oh, so I thought they were comping you the stuff that you were photographing.
No, no.
They were already comping you
yeah, because,
a
I
meal
mean,
in the first place.
You know, we're putting their restaurant in the book, so it's you know.
Man, I was happy that I got to take home a pair of Lori's salt and pepper shakers, because when I went to his signing and presentation at Waco, he was handing those out to
that was cool, so
I got to bring those home.
Yeah,
and I mean, not that I can't get it anywhere else, but you know, it's kind of a cool thing to take home with the book, right? And
yeah, definitely.
Of course, my kids immediately thought that I stole it. I have this joke that I play with my daughter, because you know, a lot of these places will let you take home something. Like if you go to the old spaghetti factory and you order an Italian soda, you can take home the glass.
Uh-huh.
It's got their logo on it, right?
Oh, great. They still do that, huh?
They still do that. The glasses are a different shape now, but they still do that. And we went there, you know, for a birthday or something. And there was maybe four Italian sodas, you know, the whole table.
Right.
And I asked my daughter to pass them all over to me. And she wouldn't do it because she thought I was going to steal them, right? She said, no, Dad, no. She's like, I'm not going to let you take these tonight.
Right.
And I said, no. I said, we can take these home. They'll let us take these home. And she goes, are you sure? And I said, yeah. So she's like, okay. So then she put them all in front of me. And then when we were leaving, I said, Sydney, come here. And so she walked over and I said, here, put these in your bag. And then she was like, no, Dad. And I said, no, we can take these home. She's like, are you sure? And I said, yeah. And right. She goes, okay. And then she starts to put them in her bag, and I said, just don't let him see you. So I was messing with her, right? And to this day, she thinks we stole them. So when I came home with the salt and pepper shaker, she thought we stole those too. So.
Yeah.
When we went to Munich, we got to go to the Trader Vic's there, and there was this one really great bartender. We actually spent his birthday there, and
uh-huh.
He hooked him up with all these great old Trader Vic's icons, you know, different mugs and Menahine and so on and so forth, equipment and all this other stuff. Of course, it was on the hush-hush because
thank you.
He wasn't supposed to be
doing right.
That, but it was actually really nice of him. Great yeah. guy. Ninyu, I think it was.
Yeah, he's not there anymore.
Oh, no. Oh. Really? No.
Those are fun times. Munich Trader Vicks, man. What a place. That it's again, we're back to the irony. To me, maybe the most authentic Trader Vicks still in existence
is in Germany.
Is the one in Munich.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's in Germany.
It was built in 1972 for the Olympics.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Which was still, you know, 1972 was still a complete old-style Trader Vicks with the birdcage and everything. Complete. And,
do you have a light, Sven?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
And, you know, it's also built in the basement of this posh hotel in these catacombs, how they should be, you know? It's not like one big room or something.
Right.
But it has these nooks and crannies, and you discover, you know, these different rooms and stuff. It's just really fantastic because it's completely unrenovated. It was always in this sort of like, you know, the Waldorf Hotel of Munich, this really posh hotel, and the clientele there was always the moneyed people of Munich. And now there's like their kids are going there. It's like generational, the customers. And so they're always, you know, busy. So
you know what I find ironic?
The need to renovate.
Yes.
What I find ironic with Trader Vicks, speaking of Trader Vicks, is that, you know, a lot of people are very strict about making a Mai Tai correctly, the way that the Mai Tai was originally developed.
Right.
And the place that originally developed the Mai Tai doesn't even make it that way anymore. They use their mix.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So they were doing that I know that they did that in Atlanta the last time I was the one in Atlanta. You had to ask for it to be made the way that they were
using. The Scratch Mai Tai.
Yeah, Scratch Mai Tai, original 1944 recipe.
I think.
Or else they would make it with their mix.
Right.
Yeah, and they would use their rums, too.
Yeah. Well, I know that when Martin worked at the San Francisco Trader Vicks, he was supposed to make it with the mix, and every time someone ordered a Mai Tai, he would make them a Scratch Mai Tai.
Yeah, he would do it.
Yeah, he would just do because it, that, whether they wanted it or not.
That's how Martin
rebels.
Exactly, yeah.
But I thought they were doing that also in L.A., right?
In L.A., I think what happened was I think they were using lemon juice instead of lime juice.
Oh.
And I think that was across the board at Vicks, too.
Oh, wow.
Which,
that's
lemons are more expensive.
That's a completely different taste, too.
Yeah, totally different taste. But
yeah, and they're about three times more expensive.
Yeah.
Or if not more.
Maybe they got a deal.
But, you know, this brings up another question that I was thinking about when I was spiking Boris's punch.
Boris's punch.
Everybody talks about the you know, ingredients and stuff. But what about my pet subject of the sipping straw?
Oh,
that,
boy.
It's not been discussed enough, you know.
That these are the straws that I use when I serve a drink in my bar.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because
cocktail straws is what I call
because
them.
Because they're stirrers and straws at the same time, which is a very good thing. Because it's good to re-stir your drink after the ice has melted. And at the same time, they're so thin that you really, you know, the drink hits your tongue in just the right amount for you to experience the flavor.
Exactly.
When you do like any thicker straws, it sort of floods your mouth and it's designed to make you finish the drink quicker.
Exactly.
But, you know,
it feels like a more authentic experience to me when I use these cocktail straws, because when I was younger, that's how my parents drank their cocktails.
Yeah.
They're drinking them out of the same kind of glasses, double rocks glass. With cocktail straws.
Because you're supposed to sip cocktails, not suck them up. That was like this, you know, Don Ho motto.
And that, you know, probably came from hotel management. Like, tell them to suck them up.
Yeah, like, sure. Drink them down
bar
faster.
Manager. Yeah, drink
them
faster.
Drunk and get them to order more drinks.
If you could create a song about people drinking faster, that'd be great.
But did that term originate with Don Ho? Isn't that just a form of pigeon?
I think so, but it's pretty great.
Well,
he definitely emblazoned it on his logo. Yeah, he branded
it. Well, he's Hawaiian.
Well, you have the glasses, you know, that say it, and it was, you know, on the menus. It
right.
Was like, suck him up.
And it's a snazzy font.
You know, when I was in the Cook Islands last year, I met one of the original Ali'is, at the resort that I was staying at. He plays music there every Tuesday night. He retired from Maui to Rarotonga, and he owns a resort on the other side of the island. And he was also a backup musician for, you know, all the greats. They all played in each other's bands.
Right.
So he played with Martin Denny and Arthur Lyman and you name it. You know, he was one of the musicians in the band, you know. So with those bands, they were all sharing musicians, you know. That was not uncommon.
Yeah, I think there was only so many musicians over there that could actually do it.
Yeah.
That had equipment and could get there.
Yeah.
Probably.
So, are you working on any other projects right now?
Well, the Art of Tiki book, the Mayan Revival exhibition, then, you know, Carrero Books wants to do a book about the Mayan Revival, which is going to be really cool because, as usual, I have more material than I can fit into the exhibition. And I can, you know, really put all that into this book. And it's not, you know, I doubt it's going to have the same effect for Mayan style than the Book of Tiki did for Polynesian style. But it's still, it was such a cool fad that, you know.
It wasn't as prolific as the Tiki style, so that's probably why.
And it's also from the 20s and 30s, so it's much more forgotten, you know.
Okay.
But then again, you know, two of the very best buildings in that style are still in existence. I mean, which is incredible for LA, that, you know, the Aztec Hotel built in 1926, I think, or 25. I think it's 25 in Monrovia still stands.
It's really cool too.
Oh, I have to see that.
And downtown in LA, the Mayan Theater from 1927.
Yeah, the Mayan
is
Theater
is unchanged.
Yeah,
and it's the most baroque, freaking interior.
You know?
You can imagine.
And it's hopping.
And it's a nightclub.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
like,
hopping.
It's been a nightclub for the past two decades. Three decades. I used to go there in the early 90s when I was in my mid-20s to go to a weekly nightclub there.
I used to go there when it was a porn theater.
I didn't know about that.
I loved showing European visitors that place. And go walk in there, and it was like and you would have these carnival acts on the big screen in this pagan temple environment.
That's funny. Have you seen the Million Dollar Theater down on Broadway?
Oh yeah,
it's across from the Bradbury Building.
I've seen, yeah.
So there's a couple of buildings like that. That's probably the most ornate one on Broadway.
No,
the
Los Angeles is.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
It's incredible. It's like a European opera house. With it from the basement to the auditorium, the amount of ornament is incredible, and thank God it survived, because, you know, downtown turned Mexican in the as early as the 70s, and then, you know, when the big renovation things happened in the 80s, the Mexican liked that kind of baroque ornate style, you know, very much like Catholic churches. And so they kept it.
Well, also, a lot of those buildings had 100-year leases.
Mm.
And so, you know, they were put up in the 20s or 30s, so they never expired. And by the time it came around time to, like, you know, take care of things, people realized, oh, my God, this is great. Like, there was one down there, the Paramount, which is gone now. It turned into some hideous office building. But I went on a tour, and the docent was really upset that the Paramount didn't get saved. And this was, you know, probably 74 or something, you know, when it was torn down and people just didn't care. You know, like the United Artists Theater, which is the Ace Hotel now, it was a bread factory for a while in the 70s. And they were just pumping the fumes and the dust into the theater.
Wow. Wait. So when did the church take it over?
I think like mid-80s.
Oh. That must have been so cool. I wish I would have gone to one of this guy's sermons. What's his name?
Dr. Gene Scott.
Gene Scott. He was such a wacko.
Yeah.
I mean, with his fucking,
I remember
cowboy.
That guy.
Yeah.
He was the TV guy every Sunday, right?
Yeah.
I think he was on
was
all the time.
From his
church.
He was, yeah, you're right. He was on all the time.
Yeah.
Whenever you put it on that channel, that guy was talking.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a memory I forgot.
I'm so happy to bring it back for you.
I appreciate that, Boris.
You're welcome.
And I have nothing for you.
That's all right. I'm used to it.
But you know, there's examples like in Detroit, the Fisher Theater was a Mayan palace equal to the Mayan Theater here in downtown, and it got completely renovated in the like late 60s.
Wow.
And it's like the perfect example of to see the auditorium before and after. It's like jaw dropping.
Like they just ruined it.
Ornate. Well, it's the funny thing. It's 60s modernism style. So it's like you could say that it's maybe cool mid-century modernism, but when you think about the great stuff that was there before, it's horrific.
Right.
Is this going to be in the book? This one?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I can't wait to see it.
I'm already hurt, but I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it's you know, it's
what
it's
about glossy, the you know. Frank Lloyd Wright?
Oh, that's another example of Mayan revival that are still extant here in LA. You know, all the Frank Lloyd Wright textile block houses that were, you know, Mayan inspired.
The
Barnesdale Park one?
By Barnesdale Park, yeah.
Yeah, that's that was his first one, the Hollyhock House.
The Hollyhock House, that's it.
But then
the name was escaping me.
There's three more here in L.A. that are still in existence. You know, the Ennis House that are...
What's the one that they use in all the movies?
That's probably the Ennis House.
Okay.
Which one's the one that's on the corner?
Above Los Feliz.
It takes up a whole corner of a mountain. Like the road goes around it.
That's the Ennis House.
Probably. Okay. Yeah, well, then what's the one that was used on, like, Top Model, where you can see it from Franklin? It's like pyramid-shaped or something?
Oh, no, it's not... Oh... That's his son Lloyd Wright did that.
Oh, okay.
That's a Black Dahlia house,
right?
Where she was supposedly killed.
Okay.
That's another amazing place and an amazing story. You know, that Steve Hodell, that coroner guy or that doctor, you know, supposed to be the guy that cut her up to, as an homage to surrealism. It's a I love these LA stories.
Don't you? Don't you? I think they're awesome too.
And I love that, you know, among all the shit that has been renovated away, there's still these amazing architectural examples that you can still just drive to any day and photograph and look at them. And, you know, that's, you know, the Mayan revival is definitely part of that. And then after the Mayan, you know, I'm trying to sort of become the specialist for American exotic, you know, appropriations of other exotic cultures. Because after the Mayan revival, I want to do Shriners and exotic fraternal orders.
Yeah, that's a good topic.
Well, that you posted the other day about your church, about the church book that you want someone else to do. But you've been saying that for as long as I've known you.
Well, the church book is really, you know, I think somebody that is more on top of mid-century modernism should do that.
Right. But those pictures you posted were a fantastic example.
I know. It's just like, you know, it puts me at peace with the world when I see those great examples of modernist architecture and that they still exist, you know.
Right.
So.
Right.
I can't understand why anybody hasn't done it yet. You know, there's so much, there's a certain amount of repetition even on, you know, modernism and stuff out there in books. But the church book, that it's a really
good. And it's endless.
There's so much, yeah.
I mean, every time me and you would go for a drive, we'd find one or two
right.
without even trying.
Right.
In fact, almost avoiding them.
All right, what about
pizza?
Yeah, okay.
What about pizza?
Can we go pepperoni sausage?
That's fine.
I don't do onions, I don't do pineapple.
Pepperoni sausage, yeah.
Pepperoni sausage is perfect.
Well, you have to order it. I'm not familiar with it.
Wait a minute. I thought you were going to take care of it.
I know, I'm going to pay for it.
He just doesn't know the neighborhood.
Yeah. I don't know the name. I never order pizza. Jesus. I order Thai food and other stuff.
Last time I ordered Thai food, it cost me $80. We're sticking to the pizza.
Hey, man, I took my son to Jelaya on Sunset.
Okay.
And you've been there.
Yeah, I mean, you went with Yoshin and it's great. Daniel Smith. Yeah,
it's great. Yeah. And I ordered the chef's special. They had like maybe 5 or 6 of them on the board. And one of them was the halibut, the black pepper halibut. That sounds good. I'm going to order. Let's have one of those. Let's get a tom yum soup. Let's get a pineapple fried rice. And let's get what else did we get? We got the crying tiger. Right?
Okay.
All solid choices. And then when we got the bill, that fucking halibut was almost $50.
Thank you, chef. What?
Yeah, well, I assumed that, and this was my fault. I should have asked for the price before I ordered it. But I assumed that because it was the special, it was one of the ones that they were...
I think special means I want to get this out of my kitchen.
Right, but... So I said, is this really... $45.
Is that a five?
Is that really? And then, because I was thinking, why is my check so big? And then I looked at the items listed, and there it was. And she pulled out the menu, and she flipped it over, and there was a section on the back of the menu that said chef specials.
Okay.
And the chef specials were all the fresh catches, all the fresh meats. So it was the opposite in that restaurant.
Okay.
So, you know, Sven... After I interviewed the guys at Oceanic Arts, that was a really interesting episode to me because they talked a lot about history and they told a lot of old stories and stuff with, you know, all the old carvers and builders and designers and places that they built. Yeah, that are all kind of, you know, just part of our tiki history now. And it made me think, you know, God, I'd really like to talk to more old timers. And they're all gone.
Right.
So the only other one that's left that I could think of is Mike Sr. at Tiki T.
That's a good point. I haven't thought about who else would be there, but...
Well, you know, you're one of the elders now, so...
Yeah.
Because I was asking Bamboo Ben, I recorded with him a few weeks later, and I said, hey, can you help me... you know, figure out who else I can talk to. And he started laughing. He goes, you know, dude, we're the elders now. And I said, nah, I can't be one of the elders. But, you know, he's like, well, you know, all those old guys are gone.
Right. Yeah. You know, I still somewhere I have like those little miniature recorder tapes.
Yeah.
Of interviews that I did with Danny Balls.
Yeah.
From the Tikis.
Yeah.
And Milan Guanco, believe it or not.
Oh, did you really?
I interviewed him.
So
you have to digitize that.
How long ago was that? When did he pass?
In the '90s.
What about Tony Ramos? Did you get to talk to him?
Yeah, but we didn't. We didn't tape him. I think.
You know, one night I was sitting at the bar with Jeff Berry at Tiki T, and he mentioned that I could go down to Ciudad in downtown LA, and Tony Ramos was still working. And he said, you know, then this was before the big revival with, you know, the craft cocktail thing. And he was like, you know, if you want to order an old Don's drink, you can get one from him. He'll make it for you still.
Right.
One of my regrets is that I never did that. Right. I should have.
But you knew Tony from Madame Wu's.
Right. That's where Jeff met him. And... You know, that was one of those key moments of urban archaeology in terms of mixology. And, if, you know, it was really for sort of a light went off for Jeff. I mean, we've already been regulars at the TKT throughout the 80s, and we knew about, you know, Ray was still there then, and we knew about his career and his drinks. But... to come to this you know, mid-century modern Chinese restaurant in Santa Monica and get like a perfect fog cutter served by an ex-Don the Beachcomber bartender was really an eye-opening experience. And you know, I think that's when Jeff Berry really sort of was put on the track of the classic recipes and stuff.
That's awesome.
Jeff told me that when Tony Ramos was at Ciudad, they had no idea who they had.
Right.
And Marie King told me some interesting stories that she was saying that they were impatient with him because he was mixing his secret syrups out of the trunk of his car before he'd go into the bar to make his cocktails. Right. And they were telling him not to do that. They were telling him, look, you can't do that out there. And if you're going to do those syrups, you need to tell us what's in them.
Right.
And so he was being defiant of that, you know, and that's how he was his whole life.
Yeah. By the time I got to see you, Dad, he was gone. And then I sent like the manager an email saying, hey, you know, do you know where Tony is? And he's like, I have no record of him working here. And then Ciudad was owned by one of the two women that owned the Border Grill.
Okay.
And then they just turned it into a Border Grill. It's a nice restaurant, but it would have been more exciting if Tony Ramos was still around.
Yeah.
So Ray obviously knew Tony, right? I mean, those guys obviously worked together
at some point.
Or were on the, you know, the Don the Beachcomber basketball team or something.
The softball team.
Tony was more from the later generation. I think he worked at the Marina and the Rugby.
Oh, okay.
And
but Madame Wu is that.
So like, he's younger than Ray.
Right.
That was a nice fit though.
Yeah, it was great.
You know, fantastic Chinese food and a Don the Beachcomber cocktail.
Do we know what happened to him?
I haven't heard. No. I don't know. Yeah. I would love to find out.
That's one of those things where, you know, I have regrets like you of not having looked him up. It's, you know, a lot of things that could have been done, and you just have to measure them against the things that have been done. And
that
has been found.
That's a good way to look at it. But I've always said that one of my biggest regrets is not speaking with my grandparents about or their grandparents.
Oh, right.
You know.
Well, thanks for putting that in my head.
Well, you know, like, by the time I was old enough to care about that stuff, they were all gone.
Right.
And so I know nothing about my lineage. And that really bugs me because it wasn't until later on in my life that I thought that would be interesting to know. You know, as a young person, you're very self-centered. You don't really care about, you know, your family's history. You just care about, you know, what you're going to do this weekend.
Well, I have an uncle who wrote like two books on our family history that I have them. They're big books. He was really into it because we're Hamiltons, and I think he was trying to like find some sort of history so he could go and claim a castle in Scotland. But it didn't work out.
Do you have a family crest or anything like that?
I think we do, but it gets complicated because my top left corner. My grandfather was adopted.
Oh, that muddies the waters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think
that
he
explains a lot.
Yeah. Well, anyway, if Tony Ramos, if you're listening, call in and Adrian, I'll get you a bumper sticker.
There you go. I wonder if we hit up so the thing is, if Mike Sr. knew anything about him, I wonder if there's anything. I don't know. I'm trying to connect the dots somewhere. You know, something that Boris brought up one time that I'd like to ask Mike Sr., because I'm trying to get the mics onto an episode. And I'm going to ask him this when I do. But there was an overlap with Tiki T and Don's in Hollywood being open for like 25 years. And I wonder if there was any kind of camaraderie or rivalry involved with that. You know, knowing that Ray had opened his own bar down the street.
I wouldn't think so. I think, you know, at that point, Don, the business, if it was Sonny or Getty running it, they thought so highly of themselves, they wouldn't feel like the competition.
Yeah, that there was any kind of threat.
Or small little.
But, I still want to know if he went there and still enjoyed it.
Did he still go there?
You know,
or were there customers that would go to both because it was similar in decor and feel.
Who was doing crawls back then?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, in the 80s, you know how I discovered Tiki was through my grandparents. I told you that story.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where they liked to celebrate their birthdays and anniversaries and special occasions, Father's Day, Mother's Day. You know, when my grandmother turned 90, she's gonna, actually in 2 weeks, we're having a birthday party for her. She's turning 97.
Oh, wow.
But when she turned 90... When she turned 90, they asked her, where do you want to have your birthday? Let's have a big birthday and we'll rent out a little space and we'll make a, you know, big party out of it. And she chose the warehouse in Marina Del Rey.
Oh, great.
And she's the person who, when they renewed their wedding vows on their 50th wedding anniversary, they had the reception at Don the Beachcomber in Marina Del Rey. So that's where they like to celebrate their special occasions. We're at Polynesian style restaurants.
Right, similar
so
food.
That's what
and
I'm getting. Yeah,
and
that's what I'm getting at is that, you know, in the 80s, you know, they would have probably gone to both if they knew about them.
Sure.
You know?
Right. But I think Tiki Tiki was, you know, just considered a bar. There was no food there.
No. Yeah, I mean...
So, yeah. It's not really competition or...
I always said if I had a time machine, I'd go back in time to before the Ray's mistake was created and ask Ray to make me his best drink. You know, by that time, he had already been bartending for 3 decades. And so he had a lot of experience,
mm-hmm.
You know. So he knew how to make a good drink, but it was before the Ray's mistake. So it was before the drink that put him on the map, right? You know, he never really did get to experience the legacy that he created. All of that came after he was gone.
Mm.
Did he see the Book of Tiki, or did he
pass? That was one of my, you know, greatest regrets. And he died like a year and a half before it came out.
Ah.
You know.
Did he know it was coming?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, it was just my story. And I don't remember if I ever showed him a mock-up or not. But, I mean, he was just a really appreciative guy when, you know, me and Jeff would, you know, needle him about stuff. And he liked telling stories. And he liked, you know, he appreciated the fact that people were interested in the history.
That's cool. Good. That's good. Well, this was an interesting talk.
Yeah, I can talk about Tiki forever.
Yeah, me too. But at the risk of boring our audience, let's wrap this up in a nice little bow and
right
and put it to bed.
Okay.
Thanks, you guys, for taking the time to sit down and record with me tonight.
We're gonna wrap it up in a nautical bow.
In a nautical bow.
A big, thick nautical rope.
I was gonna say with a nice thick square knot.
Oh, that sounds good.
What's a good nautical knot?
The monkey ball or monkey paw? Monkey fist. Minute.
The monkey's fist.
Wait a minute. Yeah, we have a chart.
Oops, we have a chart.
What they do with Jaws? Eel comes out of the cave. Eel goes back in the cave.
Oh, those are German. Those are German knot names.
Knot names?
The Hunterknoten.
There you go.
The Türkenbund.
Like a sheep shank? Isn't that one of them? All right.
Well, okay, so before we go, Sven,
yeah.
Can you say something in German for us? Can you say, would you like to sleep with me? Or then did you just say, so long, farewell?
I think I'd rather, you know, read some more nautical knots.
Nautical knots, okay, let's get that. But you have to say it in German.
Lange Trompete, Bootsmannstuhl.
The boatsman story?
Kreuzknoten. How about that one?
And with that, we bid adieu.
Adieu.
But that's not German.
No. Which one's German?
Juice.
Juice?
Juice.
That's how you say goodbye?
That's easy.
In Hamburg.
Okay. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you have any questions, comments, or would like to just give us a shout out, stop by our group page on Facebook, The Desert Oasis Room, or hit us up on Instagram at Polynesian Pop. Thanks again, Sven, and thanks again, Boris. Cheers and aloha.
Cheers.